Okay, so last week, John got us through Acts chapter 20, when in reality he was supposed to go through 22. So I'm going to fly a little bit through the first part of this stuff. But remember last time where we ended up? Does anybody remember? We ended up in Acts, the end of chapter 20 of Acts, where the Ephesian elders and their families are on the beach praying with Paul. And they're crying and they're saying, please, please don't go to Jerusalem. They were in Miletus, right here, number 14. Okay? And so, Paul's on the beach with the Ephesian elders. They pray, and then Paul's going to head towards Jerusalem. Here's Jerusalem down here. It's kind of nice that this is numbered for us, because then we know exactly the steps that they took. One of the amazing things about this part of Acts is how detailed Luke is. He tells you what ports they went to, the trade winds. He tells you who was with them, what they were doing. And it's interesting because scholars who have written about this part of the book of Acts, they say it is one of the best and most detailed accounts of navigation and sailoring that there is in the ancient world. And we know that, let's read chapter 21, verse 1. After we had torn ourselves away from them, that is the Ephesian elders and their families, we put out to sea and sailed straight to Kos. So you can see right here, they're going from Miletus to Kos. There's Kos. The next day we went to Rhodes and from there to Patara. We found a ship crossing over to Phoenicia, went on board and set sail. After sighting Cyprus and passing to the south of it, we sailed to Syria. We landed at Tyre where our ship was to unload its cargo. We sought out the disciples there and stayed with them 7 days. Through the Spirit they urged Paul not to go on to Jerusalem. When it was time to leave, we left and continued on our way. All of them, including wives and children, accompanied us out of the city. And there on the beach we knelt to pray. After saying goodbye to each other, we went aboard the ship and they returned home. So we see the trip, right? They name every port they stopped in. Miletus to Kos, around Rhodes to Patara, around the southward winds past Cyprus, and over to Tyre. So, we know where Paul went. It's interesting that the Bible does this a lot. It tells you what happened, but it doesn't do a lot of, like when it says Jesus wept, or he was thirsty. Like, yeah, he's been hanging on the cross for how long, and they probably didn't give him anything to drink when he was in jail. So, the Bible is sometimes very Spartan in the way it describes things. But it gives us a good feel for what was going on. And this is important because, once again, when scholars study this stuff, we talked last week about Sir William Ramsay. He was a skeptic of the Bible and thought, oh, there's so many things in the Bible that are just made up. And then he was a scholar, so he went and started digging around Turkey and this whole region. He was an expert in this region. He was the top dog in this region and this field of study. What happened in this area? And he came to the conclusion, Luke is an incredibly accurate historian. And we talked last week about the different things that they found. Like, you know, they used to say, well, there's no Thessalonica. That's a made-up name. And then they found arches with Thessalonica in stone. You know, things like that. So we want to pay attention to this kind of stuff. Let's read on. Verse 7. We continued our voyage from Tyre and landed at Ptolemais, where we greeted the brothers and sisters and stayed with them for a day. Leaving them the next day, we reached Caesarea and stayed at the house of Philip the Evangelist, one of the seven. Do you remember who Philip is? Mm-hmm. Who's Philip?
Was he appointed at the same time as Stephen?
Yeah, he was one of the appointed, right? And what did he do? Do you remember
the Ethiopian eunuch,
right? So he's not in Jerusalem anymore. Now he's moved on to another city. What city is he in? Caesarea, right? So he was in Jerusalem, now he's here. So he was in Jerusalem, now he's here in Caesarea. So the disciples are moving around. They're moving to East County to start a city church. Right? They're moving around and spreading the gospel, and they're just living their lives. It says here, in verse 9, he had four unmarried daughters who prophesied. So, I don't know how old these... We don't know a lot about the daughters or even about Philip, but he had four daughters. I mean, that was a powerful household there, four daughters who prophesied. And I bring this up because... Do you think these four daughters were spiritual? What do you think? I'd probably say, you know, see your dad do a few miracles, you'd start prophesying too, right? So, I bring this up, role of the women in the church. I really think sometimes we misunderstand role of women in the church. If you have four prophesying daughters, let them prophesy, right? And I've talked with several people about this. I think sometimes we read into the Bible things from our culture that don't necessarily apply. Yeah, the Jewish culture was very conservative, but I'm very sure that these daughters were allowed to prophesy at church. That's a whole other lesson, but I do want to mention that because sometimes we underestimate the role of the women in the church, how important their role is, you know. Women in the church, in the early church, they were the ones who usually housed house churches where the disciples met. We know that women in the early church traveled for the church. We know, for instance, that Syntyche, she was the one who took the book of Romans from Paul and took it to Rome. So imagine the responsibility that she had to carry one of the largest books in the New Testament, to take that with her from one congregation to another, the trust that Paul put in them and the women, right? And this was started by Jesus, right? Jesus was very radical in that. I mean, if you were a Jewish rabbi, you didn't walk around with women in your entourage, but Jesus did. So sometimes we have to rethink culture in our church, right? So we think, well, you know, this was a man's world. All the books of the Bible have, except for Ruth, have men's names on them, right? But we have to rethink, what was Jesus doing that was radically changing the culture? Excuse me? Oh, Esther. Thank you. Ruth and Esther. We don't want to forget Esther. She did something pretty important. So, anyway, I thought that was an important point. And Paul and Jesus and the other apostles, they believed in an important role for women in the church. Verse 10. After we had been there a number of days, a prophet named Agabus came down from Judea. Coming over to us, he took Paul's belt, tied his own hands and feet with it, and said, "The Holy Spirit says, in this way the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem will bind the owners of this belt and will hand him over to the Gentiles." When we heard this, we and the people there pleaded with Paul not to go up to Jerusalem. Then Paul answered, "Why are you weeping and breaking my heart? I am ready not only to be bound, but also to die in Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus." When he would not be dissuaded, we gave up and said, "The Lord's will be done." After this, we started on our way up to Jerusalem. Some of the disciples from Caesarea accompanied us and brought us to the home of Mnason, where we were to stay. He was a man from Cyprus and one of the early disciples. Let's talk about this a little bit. So we have Paul. Agabus comes and says, "Something bad's going to happen to you in Jerusalem. Don't go." What's Paul's response? And why do you think Paul responded the way he did? Let's talk.
He had a job to do.
He had a job to do? Okay.
The Spirit was already warning him about it.
You know, I hadn't thought about that. That's a great point. The Spirit may have already told Paul, "You're going to have problems in Jerusalem." Anything else?
He was tired and he wanted to get back home.
Okay, that's a good answer. I mean, yeah. Any other ideas? We know that Paul had taken a Nazarite vow. He was just dead set on getting to Jerusalem. He knew he had to get to Jerusalem, and nothing was going to dissuade him. Maybe the Spirit had told him several times, you're going to have trials in Jerusalem. But as we look through the rest of the book of Acts, what you're going to see is something very interesting that I think is interesting anyway, that despite all the warnings and all the people trying to dissuade Paul from going to Jerusalem, Paul had had a prophecy from Jesus that said he was going to go where? That he was going to speak to the highest powers in the empire, that he was going to speak to the emperor. Paul knew. God had told him, I have a special mission for you. You have to go to Rome. And we'll see this come up later in the book. And so Paul, knowing, well, I have to get to Rome. The Lord wouldn't tell me that I have to get to Rome if I'm not going to get there. All right, let's go on. After this, we started on our way up to Jerusalem. Some of the disciples from Syria accompanied us and brought us up to the home of Mnason, where we were to stay. He was a man from Cyprus and one of the early disciples. When he arrived at Jerusalem, the brothers and sisters received us warmly. The next day, Paul and the rest of us went to see James, and all the elders were present. Paul greeted them and reported in detail what God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. When they heard this, they praised God. Then they said to Paul, you see, brothers, how many thousands of Jews have believed, and all of them are zealous for the law. They have been informed that you teach all the Jews who live among the Gentiles to turn away from Moses. Tell them not to circumcise their children and live according to our customs. What shall we do? They will certainly hear that you have come. So do what we tell you. There are four men with us who have made a vow. Take these men, join in their purification rites, and pay their expenses so that they can have their heads shaved. Then everyone will know there is no truth about these reports about you, but that you yourselves are living in obedience to the law. As for the Gentile believers, we have written to them our decision that they abstain from food sacrificed to idols, from blood, from the meat strangled animals, and from sexual immorality. The next day, Paul took the men and purified himself along with them. Then he went to the temple to give notice of the date when the days of purification would end and the offering would be made for each of them. Okay, so Paul gets to Jerusalem. The church greets him. They're excited about his ministry to the Gentiles. And then they make a suggestion to him. It's not a command, it's a suggestion. What's that suggestion?
He would take part in the rituals of with these other men, so it looks like he's observing Jewish customs.
Yeah, why would Paul agree to do something like this, and why were they suggesting it to him?
Acceptance.
Acceptance. What do you mean acceptance?
Well, looking like the rest of the rituals that were going on.
Is Paul going around and telling Jews to stop following the law?
No.
He isn't. So what are the elders in Jerusalem trying to do? Rhoda, you had your hand up.
I was going to say that Paul, in a sense, is trying to do, he said they'll be all things to all people, so in order to be relatable.
Yeah, I think that's right on. I think Paul is saying, okay, I'm not going around telling Jews they need to stop following the law. That's not what I'm doing. What I'm telling Gentiles is they don't have to follow the law in order to be saved. That's very clear in all of his writings, right? But what are the elders trying to do to help Paul's ministry, and what's Paul trying to do to help the elders' ministry? Why are they doing this?
To unite.
What do you mean? Explain a little thorough.
I think they're trying to unite the people so that they don't alienate, so then they can make the impression on everyone.
Yeah, it's not about, I think my way is better in the ministry. It's about what is going to work to help all of us get along. See, Paul knew that if this rumor was going around him, he was writing to churches in Galatia. He was writing to churches in Ephesus. He was saying, Don't circumcise your kids. Don't circumcise. You don't need to be circumcised to be saved. Right? So somehow the message got out that he was telling Jews that they didn't need to be circumcising their kids. Right? And so Paul knows he's not doing this, but other people don't. So Paul is even though he's being all things to all men, he is concerned about appearances because he knows that if people think about him, if something is going to be a barrier to people being saved, he'll do whatever it takes. Right? And this is important because this happens in the church. Is it okay to drink or not to drink beer? Is it okay to watch certain movies or not watch certain movies? Well, if it's going to help somebody stay faithful or be saved or come to a knowledge of the truth, then I'm going to do whatever it takes. If I have to stand on my head, you know, every morning to help somebody come to faith, I'm going to do it. That was Paul's attitude. And that kind of needs to be, I think, our attitude, right? That we have to be careful how we come across in public, and we have to be careful with how we interact and the impressions we give people, because sometimes, even though we may not mean to, the impressions we give people keeps them going, I'm interested in the gospel or not. This person's, you know, you're off-putting. Paul said, okay, you want me to do this? It kind of reminds me of when Paul had Timothy circumcised. Do you remember that? Timothy didn't have to be circumcised, but Paul asked him to be circumcised, and Timothy said, okay. It's because Paul knew that if Timothy were to go with him somewhere and he wasn't circumcised, it could be a stumbling block to his outreach. This is very important. And it's going to come up over and over and over and over. So here's where we get to the problem. Verse 27. When the 7 days were nearly over, some Jews from the province of Asia saw Paul at the temple. They stirred up the whole crowd and seized him, shouting, "Fellow Israelites, help us! This is the man who teaches everyone everywhere against our people and our law and this place. And besides, he has brought Greeks into the temple and defiled this holy place." They had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, in the city with Paul and assumed that Paul had brought him into the temple. See? Assumptions, rumors. The whole city was aroused and the people came running from all directions, seizing Paul. They dragged him from the temple and immediately the gates were shut. While they were trying to kill him, news reached the commander of the Roman troops that the whole city of Jerusalem was in an uproar. He at once took some officers and soldiers and ran down to the crowd. When the rioters saw the commander and his soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. The commander came up and arrested him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. Then he asked who he was and what he had done. Some in the crowd shouted one thing and some another. And since the commander could not get the truth because of the uproar, he ordered that Paul be taken into the barracks. When Paul reached the steps, the violence of the mob was so great he had to be carried by the soldiers. The crowd that followed kept shouting, "Get rid of him!" Listen, I kind of started thinking, wait a minute. Paul is, he's somewhere near the temple. A crowd rushes and says, "Hey, this is the guy." Now, see what we talked about with rumors. Gossip. Rumors had gotten out that Paul was teaching Jews to not obey the law, which is not what Paul was teaching. Now it's beginning to impact his ministry, his outreach, and his safety. This was why Paul was so anxious to say, "Okay, elders, this is a great suggestion. I'm going to go do it." And even in the midst of showing one of the most dedicated ways of showing that you're a committed Jew, he's being persecuted. The interesting thing is to me, is that this is the same accusation they launched against Stephen. He's teaching that you don't have to obey the law. Right? Remember Jesus, when Jesus said, "Destroy this temple and I'll raise it up in 3 days." Oh, he's going to destroy the temple! Right? Same thing they launched against Stephen. Oh, Stephen's teaching that you don't have to obey the law. Stephen's like, "No, look, brothers and fathers, I know my history." Boom, 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 boom. Jesus is the fulfillment of the law. Not the end of the law, the fulfillment of the law. So I'm not breaking any of the law. I'm actually more committed to the law than you are. Now let's look at this. This is the temple right here. Okay, this is Jerusalem. And here's the temple. And I said, okay, how did they... They're shouting and screaming, and this is the guy, let's kill him. They're starting to beat him up. And all of a sudden, Roman soldiers show up to rescue him. What's going on? How did that happen? How did they get the message so quickly? Well, here's the temple. And... Here's a picture of the temple up close. Paul's over here in the temple doing his Nazirite vow. They say, hey, this is the guy. Let's get him. Let's kill him. Let's get rid of him. They drag him out. They're beating him up. And then the soldiers and the commander hear the uproar. Well, here are the Roman barracks right here. These are all Roman barracks because... Next to the temple, the Romans had built, Herod had built the fort, and the Romans actually occupied it. And those Romans were all stationed in Jerusalem, right next to the temple. Why would they do that? If there's going to be an uproar in Jerusalem, where do you think it's going to start? Where's the one hot spot in all of Jerusalem that could create more controversy? The temple. So the Romans knew if we keep people around the temple calm, because when the Passover came, this place was super busy, bustling. It's like Grand Central in New York. And the Romans said, if we want to keep Jerusalem and Judah calm, we need to put ourselves right here in the middle of the action. So Paul's getting beat up, and they believe that this is right here where Paul, the soldiers rush out with the captains, they run out, and they surround Paul, and this is where they got him. And the crowd's probably down here yelling, kill him, kill him, get rid of him. Here's the temple. Here are the Roman barracks. Here are the Romans. They're surrounding Paul. They have him in chains. Let's go to verse 37. As the soldiers were about to take Paul into the barracks, so he's here. They're carrying him because he can't walk. He's so beaten up. They're going to take him into the barracks for protection so they don't kill him. Verse 37, as the soldiers were about to take Paul into the barracks, he said, asked the commander, may I say something to you? Do you speak Greek? He replied. Aren't you the Egyptian who started a revolt and led 4,000 terrorists out into the wilderness some time ago? Actually, historically, that did actually happen. There were constantly people showing up saying, I'm the Christ, follow me, let's get rid of these Romans. And they would round up people and try to fight the Romans. Paul answered, I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no ordinary city. Please let me speak to the people. After receiving the commander's permission, Paul stood on the steps and motioned to the crowd. So Paul's right here on the steps speaking. Let's read on. Let's find out. What verse was I in? 40. Verse 39.
42, verse 1.
42, verse 1. 22, verse what?
1.
Oh, let's go back a little bit. Verse 40. After receiving the commander's permission, Paul stood on the steps and motioned to the crowd. When they were all silent, he said to them in Aramaic, brothers and fathers, listen now to my defense. When they heard him speak to them in Aramaic, they became very quiet. Then Paul said, I am a Jew born in Tarsus, Cilicia, but brought up in this city. I studied under Gamaliel and thoroughly trained in the law of our ancestors. I was zealous for God as any of you are today. I persecuted the followers of this way to their death, arresting both men and women, throwing them into prison. As the high priest and all the council can testify, I even obtained letters from them to their associates in Damascus and went there to bring these people as prisoners to Jerusalem to punish. About noon I came near Damascus. Suddenly a bright light from heaven flashed around me. I fell to the ground and heard a voice say to me, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Who are you, Lord? I asked. I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting, he replied. My companions saw the light, but they did not understand the voice of him who was speaking to me. What should I do, Lord? I asked. Get up, the Lord said, and go into Damascus. There you will be told all that you have to been assigned to do. So let's go back here and let's see what Paul's trying to do. Verse 12 says, a man named Ananias came to see me. He was a devout observer of the law. See that? He was a devout observer of the law. So I was a devout Jew, and the guy who converted me was a devout Jew. See, I'm even finishing up doing a Nazarite vow with these four other Jewish brothers. They probably saw that his head was shaved. Right? He was a devout observer of the law and highly respected by all the Jews living there. He stood beside me and said, Brother Saul, receive your sight. And at that very moment, I was able to see him. Paul begins his defense. Paul was trying to show that he too was a Jew with strong ties to his tradition. Right? He says, hey, I was a Jew. I was trained by Gamaliel. He was Jewish by ethnicity. There were a lot of Jews who had converted to Judaism who weren't Jewish by blood. Paul was. I'm Jewish by blood. I was raised in Jerusalem. Even though I wasn't born in Jerusalem, I was raised in Jerusalem. There were probably people, there may have been people in the crowd who knew Paul from when he was a kid, from when he was a young man, who knew that he had studied under Gamaliel. It didn't matter to them. Trained by Pharisee, by the well-known teacher Gamaliel. Gamaliel was a very well-respected teacher in Jerusalem. He was zealous for the tradition of his ancestors. So zealous, as a matter of fact, that he persecuted the church. I even went to the high priest and said, let me get those Christians and kill them and arrest them. We can't have this. I'm going to stomp them out. He was even converted by a devout Jew. So Paul is doing something to try to, even in the midst of being killed, he's still trying to be all things to all men. What's he doing? Connecting. What do you mean by that?
Well, just by showing them who he was, he's going to sneak into villages, like I said, sneak into villages, and preach the gospel to them.
Yeah.
He's going to touch their soul. He's yoking with them right now.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. It's funny how he speaks Greek to the Roman soldier, then turns around and speaks Aramaic. I gotta make a connection real quick here, so let me speak in Aramaic. Right? Paul is trying to convey the gospel to the Jews with a Jewish emphasis. Just like in Acts 17, he tries to reach the Athenians with a Greek emphasis. He's trying to be all things to all men. In that passage in Acts 17:28, he even quotes Greek poets. Just as some of your poets have said, we are all God's offspring. My question is, are we being like Paul, like Jesus in our ministry? Are we trying to be all things to all men? Hey, I'm reaching out to somebody right now, a 20-year-old African-American woman. So what am I doing? I'm calling all my African-American female friends and saying, hey, can you help me? I'm not African-American, and I'm not a woman, and I'm not certainly not 20 anymore. Can you help me out? Right? So we've got to think. Yeah, I'm called to love everybody and share my faith with everybody and teach everybody respect, but I necessarily am not the person to be able to help somebody understand God's love in the best way possible. So when I reach out to women, I get women involved with them. I reach out to older gentlemen, I get older gentlemen involved with them. Trying to be all things to all men. This is important. Paul shows us in a very real, concrete way how to do that. Let's go to chapter 23. We're going to start doing some skipping. How am I doing on the time? See? You weren't looking. Okay. Let's look at verse 26 very quickly at chapter 22. So they were going to beat Paul. Verse 25. As they stretch him out to flog him, Paul said to the centurion standing there, Is it legal for you to flog a Roman citizen who hasn't even been found guilty? When the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and reported, "What are you going to do?" he asked. "This man is a Roman citizen." There were laws. Lex Portia is one example that basically said that Roman citizens could not be beaten. There are stories of Caesars taking away privileges from entire cities. There was a case where a Roman citizen was crucified, and he took all the privileges away from that city for doing that to one Roman citizen. So the Romans were, these commanders knew, if we beat Paul, we could be liable to death. It was illegal. You could not beat a Roman citizen. And then he says, and he's not even been found guilty of anything. So imagine, well, we better respect Roman citizens, but if he's Jewish, go ahead and beat him and get the answers out of him, right? Who cares? He's Jewish. Oh, wait a minute. He's a Jew with Roman citizenship. Don't do it. Verse 27, the commander went to Paul and asked, "Tell me, are you a Roman citizen?" "Yes, I am," he answered. Then the commander said, I had to pay a lot of money for my citizenship. "But I was born a citizen," Paul replied. Those who were about to interrogate him withdrew immediately. The commander himself was alarmed when he realized that he had put Paul, a Roman citizen, okay, he hasn't even beaten him, in chains. He was even concerned that he had put him in chains. Uh-oh, if word gets out they took a Roman citizen and put him in chains when he wasn't even found guilty, I can be in serious trouble. So let me ask you this. We talked a little bit about that last week. Paul knows that if he goes to Jerusalem, there's nothing but trouble waiting for him. Agabus told him, the Holy Spirit probably told him several times. Brothers and sisters were saying, "Don't go to Jerusalem. We love you, Paul. Stay here. You have a great ministry here. We need your teaching. We need your zeal. Stay here, Miletus. I got to go to Jerusalem. Don't break my heart." But we know that sometimes Paul went into places he knew he was going to get persecuted and beaten. And there were times where Paul could have said, "I'm a Roman citizen, don't beat me." But he said, "No, I'm going to let him beat me." We mentioned this last week, but let's bring it up again. Why would Paul, knowing that he was going to get in trouble, knowing that he was going to be persecuted, knowing that he would be beaten with rods or flagellum, why would he allow that to happen? This time he chose to say, "Yeah, I'm a Roman citizen." Paul says, "Is it legal to beat a Roman citizen?" He didn't do that when he was in Philippi. He let them beat him, right? So why is what's going on?
I think you shared last week that it was possibly to help protect the church. You know, like he takes a beating and then they find out he's a Roman citizen, and then they're like, "Whoa, we shouldn't have done that." You know, I mean, we don't want to mess with any of his guys.
Yeah. Historically, here's what's going on. See, Rome had a council that decided what was legal and what wasn't legal religiously in the country. And the pagan religions were, you know, the Romans were very open to religion. They're like, "Okay, oh, you worship Isis? Great. Bring your idol over here and put it in Rome, here in the temple in Rome. We love your God." See, the Romans were about conquest. Roman culture was, we want to control. We want to be the most powerful. Roman glory was all about conquest and Romifying everything, making sure that everybody knew the laws. And see, in most places, it was what the king said was the law. In Rome, they had laws. And we've adopted some of those practices. We've passed them down through our culture, in the Western culture. And so Rome accepted everybody's gods. They even said, "Well, the Jews, people have tried to subjugate the Jews. They don't believe in all the gods. They only believe in their God. Let's just leave the Jews alone because we've had enough problems with them." Judea was a very difficult province to manage. It was a pain in everybody's, you know, rear. "Oh, I don't want to go to Judea. That's way out there in the east and it's the pain." So they said, "Let's let the Jews worship however they want." To the point where it was illegal for Roman soldiers and Roman armies to go into Jerusalem with the standards. because it would have the image of Caesar on it. And what do the Jews believe about images? It was they didn't want images because someone might start worshiping it. So Rome was not allowed. Roman soldiers were not allowed to go into Jerusalem, and certainly not the temple, with anything that had an image on it, because the Romans didn't want the Jews to rebel, even though they did several times. And so they said, "Okay, Judaism is a legal religion." So you'll hear over and over as you read through Acts, how many times the Jews say, "He's teaching something that is not allowed in the Jewish law. He's breaking Roman law by breaking Jewish law." Right? Verse 1. Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin, chapter 22. Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin and said, "My brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day." So Paul's saying, "I'm not breaking Jewish law, therefore I'm not breaking Roman law." You weren't allowed to break Jewish law when you were in Judea and Jerusalem because the Romans didn't want you creating trouble. If you're breaking Jewish law in Jerusalem, it's like, okay, I'm going to go to Medina, the heart, or Mecca, the heart of Islam, and take the Quran and start burning it. "Look, guys, I'm burning the Quran. What's going to happen to me?" Okay? I'll be dead, you know, in blink of an eye. So what the Jews are trying to do is they're trying to accuse Paul of breaking Jewish law in the most holy place of Judaism. "You took a Gentile into the temple? Kill him." Now, how much time do I have? Because you're not keeping track for me here.
46.
Okay, we'll stop in 1 minute. We'll stop here. So, as we go through this, think about Roman law is to worship the gods respectfully. In Jerusalem and Judea, you worship the Jewish God respectfully the way he wants. And the argument that the Jews are making against Paul is not only is he not respecting Jewish law, but he's a pest because now that he's breaking Jewish law, he's also breaking Roman law. That's very important. And notice what Luke does through the rest of the book of Luke with Paul and his relationship with Rome and his relationship to the law, the Roman law and the Jewish law. Let's take a break.